Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Our Dakota political junkies today are John Hunter. He's the publisher of the Madison Daily Leader, joining us from Madison. Hi, John.
Hi, Lori.
And welcoming back Noel Hamill. He's the former publisher of the Mitchell Daily Republic and a member of the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. Noel, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
John, I feel like every time we say South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame, we should shoot a confetti gun or offer something for Noel.
I try to bow down in Noel's presence every time.
Is that what? Okay, I'll make sure the first time I meet him in person, I'll reenact that for you and get a picture. All right, we just got off the phone with Argus Leader reporter Patrick Anderson. We were talking about politics of ethanol, and it has sort of got me to thinking, Noel, that this conversation has been around for some time in the state, and I'm wondering if you had anything that you wanted to add to sort of this relationship the state has with federal regulation that benefits us versus really not wanting too much regulation.
You know, that's... I actually don't know where this is going. I think we're getting sort of mixed signals on this. I know how important ethanol is not only to South Dakota farmers and corn prices, which, as you know, have been depressingly low. I was looking at some information the other day, and $3 corn isn't expected, I don't think, to go much above $3.35. So the ethanol piece is important. And everybody is concerned about what the Trump administration is going to do to ethanol because he's, said some pretty strong things about, deregulation, and or not deregulation, but the impact of the oil industry. And honestly, I don't know. He said a positive thing, when was it, a month ago at that National Ethanol Conference, that he thinks renewable fuels are important. But I honestly don't have a crystal ball on where that's going. I'm sorry.
John, are we always sort of doing this dance of, courting regulation that is beneficial to the economy in South Dakota and sort of, weeding through regulation that we think is overly, overly intrusive to us? How do we kind of manage that as a state? See, I'm getting all big and philosophical with John Hunter again. But
well, it's true that we've always done that. I mean, if you look back in history books or in publications about South Dakota history, we're always trying to strike that balance between individual freedoms or kind of corporate freedoms, property rights, and those kind of things, and regulations that would benefit South Dakota. So yes, it's been going on a long time. I suspect it goes on in other states, and it probably will go on continuously. And ethanol is a little bit of a unique animal, and the fact that, as Noel was describing, it's a very good thing for the state's economy, and has been for corn prices, and that spills over to a lot of other industries. But we're not used to having things kind of mandated, or the mandate of usage of things. But nevertheless, I do think this is not as uncertain as some people may say. You know, that with Trump saying some positive things at that ethanol conference, but also having a lot of oil people in the cabinet, it would look like it's unstable. But what I think that ends up being is fairly neutral. It kind of cancels each other, and I don't think it's going to be at all a priority for President Trump. He's attacking on a lot of other areas, so I don't think ethanol is going to be at the front of his agenda.
How significant is the congressional delegation then from South Dakota in sort of digging in their heels and making sure that isn't that nobody comes after it for the state?
Well, I think it has. I mean, it really depends on, not necessarily with the administration, but other members of Congress. And the corn states, as however you define that, is not a particularly big number. So you have to have friends in other parts of the country in order to keep these things. And so different states have different what would you call goals with renewables, or even definitions of what those are. So I think it's really the ability of our delegation to convince other states' delegations that this is an important piece in the puzzle.
Let's talk about journalism for a moment here, John, because you were recently on a panel that was sort of talking about this notion of fake news and the role of the media right now in this national conversation. Is this something that we've been talking about always and people are noticing it more, or is there more a call right now for journalists to come out and sort of have these public conversations about their role, their challenges, and to encourage, you know, readers and listeners to pay closer attention? What do you think?
Well, both Noel and I have been in journalism for quite a while, and so we've seen these different trends that go on. But remember a couple things with journalism that have happened. One, the barriers to entry of getting into journalism have gone from something big to almost nothing. In other words, it used to be, to be a disseminator of news, you had to own a printing press or a television station or have some other kind of access. Well, with the internet, anyone can publish anytime, and depending on how well it gets forwarded, it could be broad. So there's a lot more we call news, opinion, fake news, all those kinds of things out there. And so what happens is then readers have to be more diligent about what they select, and that's one of the responsibilities. It's a responsibility of the rest of us too to do our best and provide the truth in everything that we do. And certainly nobody would want any sort of regulation of that. In other words, that people publishing on the internet or any other place would have to go through some sort of panel to see if it's legitimate or anything like that. That's the last thing anyone wants, to restrict the freedom of the press.
Right.
So, but I do think it's a bit of a caveat emptor that readers have to do some things to try to determine if the things that they're reading are true or not.
Noel, what's the conversation that we should be having now and about the role of journalists and journalism, the media, versus conversations we've had in the past?
I just think it's much more difficult for the consumer today than it ever has been. There's so much more information out there. Some of it's trustworthy, some of it's mere propaganda. I think it's really unfortunate that we live in a time where we can't rely on certain sources of information to a greater degree than we do. And then people are busier. And then the other aspect that I see is that communities, which have always relied upon, you know, their local newspaper like John's in Madison or local radio station, you know, the small communities are sort of, many of them are struggling, and the larger communities are struggling with cohesiveness, and so the media's role is changing at the same time that you have all these different sources of information. So I'm old enough to remember when you could turn on Walter Cronkite, pretty much expect it to be the straight stuff,
right?
And pick up your daily newspaper, or turn on the local radio station, and you know, you didn't have to be so concerned as to whether or not what you were getting was true, and that's all changed. And I agree with John. We certainly don't want any sort of test or restrictions on news media. At the same time, I do believe that there's an awful lot of irresponsibility out there, primarily online, because a lot of the online sources are not held to the same standard of libel, defamation, as our newspapers or public radio or television. And so, you know, the internet streams, and it's, I mean, there's countless examples of the damage that have been done. So it's just a quagmire. And I think, John, I think you and I could make $1 million easily if we would come up with one source of news that people could turn to, sort of a voice in the wilderness that people could trust. I think we could mint that, John. And
yeah, let's work on that next time we get together.
John, what's the role of a local newspaper like the Madison Daily Leader right now in 2017? How is that? I know you take that seriously. What kind of conversations and contemplation are you having now about going forward?
Well, there's a temptation, I think, in newspapering. Remembering that we have so much more competition now is to try to crank up the speed. In other words, to try to get things released faster, published faster, however that is done. And the temptation is, I think, always to get that out as quickly as it can, maybe before you'd be as thorough as you normally would be. So when we discuss that kind of stuff, we keep saying we're not going to compromise any of our journalistic standards just for the sake of speed. Yes, we want to be fast. Yes, we want to get it out as quickly as we can, but we're not going to cut any corners to do that. Remembering, too, that if it's published on paper, then when people look back at it X years from now, they're not going to look at the next 3 days after that to see if you have any corrections that go to that. They're just going to look at that one article the day that the event happened. So you have to be right the first time and right the second time and write, you know, every follow-up story. So I think the focus, Lori, is on speed and not sacrificing any journalistic standards in order to achieve it.
Let's move on to some of the other big stories of the week in the state. Here in a few minutes, we'll have Secretary of Game, Fish, and Parks Kelly Hepler on to talk about this legislation to allow recreational use of flooded land, kind of a complex issue we'll dig into here in a bit. But, Noel, I am wondering if you've been following that at all and Game, Fish, and Parks' decision to sort of pull some of those ramps or access points away as we as they wait for clear guidance from the state legislature.
You know, I had this conversation 20 years ago with a lawmaker from the northeast part of the state. I was going to name him, but I guess I won't. And the question was, you know, what about public access to flooded lands? Because, as you know, that's where most of the flooding has occurred. And, you know, it's not been resolved. The court did throw it back in the lap of the legislature, and I know the Game, Fish, and Parks now has limited access to some of those lakes, although I'm not sure that real access is limited. I just think it's limited in some locations. But I think it's a property rights issue. I've always felt that way. If you own a parcel of land and you're paying taxes on it, and part of that land is flooded, I really think that you know, you ought to have some control over the water on that land. And I'm somewhat familiar with the state's laws protecting, water is a public resource, whether it's surface water or groundwater. But I think from a property rights standpoint and from a historical perspective on property rights, landowners really have the best argument in this issue.
John, do you have something to add to that, a little background?
You guys know more about this than I do, but I concur with Noel that property rights in South Dakota have always been important, and not 100% property rights. In other words, you can do whatever you want with your property regardless of others. But yes, I think as these public waters are encroaching, it's a challenge there. In Lake County, we have some well-established lakes, but you can always kind of tell where the high water mark is. And, you know, then you say, okay, the public has the right to be in certain places. We don't have kind of ever-changing places like up in Day County and other places. Mm. So it is a challenging issue, and I don't want to simplify that in any way.
All right, and then also on the theme of Game, Fish, and Parks, we had this announcement this week about the Spearfish Canyon, Bismarck Lake land swap, really everything being put on pause there. And what do you make of that, Noel?
Well, you know, the budget, I saw where the governor, you know, acknowledged because of the sales tax revenue, the budget shortfall, but coming up, what was it, $2.5 million to be set aside for that deal was probably not going to happen because the economy is slower than we want it to be. But I was a little surprised a couple of months ago when all the opposition started to form against that project and that land swap. And I, you know, it's, they said the Forest Service was doing a good job and they didn't want the extra development there and they didn't want the extra traffic. These are mostly, I think, from people that live in that part of the state. And so, you know, it would be hard to support the governor's idea at this stage for those two reasons.
John, your thoughts?
Well, it seems like it's ripe for compromise, and that is, you know, the people who are challenging it because they don't want the development, maybe it can be maintained with less development or something that would satisfy them. Yet, South Dakota has a long, rich history of having land available for citizens and the natural beauty of South Dakota, and so to have that available, I think, is a good idea. But as Noel pointed out, the cost of starting or, you know, developing parks is real. And in a year like we have, where budget expectations of revenue fell short, it's a good thing to pause. And so I think they can come up with a compromise, and when the money becomes available in a future year, maybe put some more development together.
Maybe some more clarity on that. Let's talk about a little bit of clarity, things coming into focus with the U.S. House race. Chantel Krebs, Dusty Johnson, early numbers show Krebs sort of beating Johnson by a little bit on the fundraising numbers. How significant are those early numbers, Noel?
Well, it looks like they both can raise money, and I'm not surprised because they're both, in my opinion, they're both attractive, capable candidates. I mean, and I'm sure John has too. They've been around for a while, and they're smart, and they're articulate, and they're good candidates. And so I look forward to a good primary. I'm really going to be interested to see what issues actually separate those two candidates.
Right.
My interest, actually, and you didn't ask this question, but my interest goes more to who the Democrats will come up with to run for that seat. And I had some conversations a few weeks ago on that with some people in the House, and you know, I just don't know who's going to run. The Democrats are kind of going to be up against a pretty strong candidate. So what fascinates me is who's going to step up and run for that seat from the Democrats.
You said Paula. I'm assuming you mean Paula Hawks.
Paula Hawks, you know, she ran last time, but you know, I think we have to go back to Stephanie Hirsa Sandlin to name a Democrat who had won that seat, and she obviously is not going to run. She just took a new job at Augie. So,
right.
But you know, you almost need a candidate of that stature, don't you?
What do you think, John? Do you need someone of that stature to give someone like Chantel Krebs and Dusty Johnson a good race?
Probably, and there might be them out there. You know, one of the challenges of Democrats in for a House race is that there aren't as many who have name recognition. In other words, you don't have someone who is already holding a different statewide office who would be available for that. You may have some legislative leaders, the minority leaders, who could fit into that. But yes, the two candidates, Secretary Krebs and Dusty Johnson, have a good lead already in terms of an unnamed candidate on the other side. So a little bit like the governor's race, this one could possibly be decided at the primary, either without or a uncontested general election.
John, do you think Paula Hawks ran a strong enough campaign to come back and run again and sort of gain traction and name recognition?
I do. I was impressed with that campaign. And had a chance to meet her in person, and I did think it was credible, and I think she built up some name recognition and would be a would be a good candidate for a future office like that.
All right, we're going to let you go. We'll pick up this conversation next time. John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. John, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lori.
Noel Hamel, former publisher of the Mitchell Republic and member of the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. Thank you, Noel. We'll see you next
thank
time.
Thank you so much.